Warning, this podcast contains heavy spoilers for not just one movie, but entire franchises. We highly recommend going and watching these movies before listening to us as a companion piece that stitches all the timelines into one creepy, crime-ridden story. There will be no more spoiler warnings. We do not break character. After this, there is no turning back. You've been warned. Hit the music.
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
So a man finds out his wife is cheating on him, and he walks into a bar. Bartender asks, "Why are you looking so blue?" Man replies, "Just found out my wife has been cheating on me. I've decided I'm going to drink myself to death. I'll have some whiskey, please." Bartender looks shocked and says, "I'm sorry, but I can't help you kill yourself." The man asks, "Well, what would you do in my situation?" The bartender thinks for a bit and says, "If I found out a guy was sleeping with my wife, I wouldn't sit around feeling sorry for myself. I'd kill him." The man jumps up off the stool and shouts, "That's a great idea, thanks," and runs out of the bar. A couple of hours go by and the bartender is starting to get nervous. Suddenly, the man walks back into the bar with a big smile on his face. Did you kill the guy?" the bartender asks nervously. "Nope, slept with your wife. Whiskey, please." Got one more for you. What's the difference between a cheating wife and a joke?
I have no idea.
Will Smith can't take a joke. Hello and welcome to It's Alive Alive Podcast. This is a true crime paranormal interstellar podcast covering unbelievable stories that sound like they were ripped straight from the pages of a Hollywood script. Ooh, I need breath. I am your host, the man of many names, the outlaw Harry Ray, the bruiser Bronson, Dr. HR Smokenstein, THC, or you can call me Josh for short. And with me as always is my very own Scream Queen, the perfect combination of beauty and brains and brightest Smokenstein, the India Horror, the expert, the guts and gore, the gorgeous, the sexy Amy Rose.
Hi.
Okay, so again, I've said this in all our episodes this week.
Mm-hmm.
I fucked up with the scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted me to pick a story that was uplifting for women, and I picked one about an absolute fucking lunatic.
Yep.
Who does not do the female gender any real justice.
Nope.
And that is Alex Forrest. I keep calling her Frost. I don't know why.
Is there a celebrity called Alex Frost? Was one of Atomic Kitten called Alex Frost?
I don't know, but I keep calling her Frost. Forrest is her name.
Yes.
Alex Forrest. Okay, so I know this story doesn't do a great job at like painting women in a great light. But this is one particular woman. And
she wasn't entirely to blame either at the same time.
No, but I think this is a big cautionary tale. Because I think, obviously, like, with all our stories, it ends with the bad guy dying, usually.
Yeah.
And in this case, is she really a bad guy? I don't know. We're going to kind of dig deeper into that. But it does kind of open up the whole thing of the... it's a term I've only heard recently, and that's femicide.
Never heard of it.
Well, I didn't really know that. I just thought murder is murder. Man, woman, whatever, you know? I knew that they kind of separated hate crimes when it is against a minority or something like that. But I didn't realize... I never really thought about it. Obviously, because you have patricide, matricide, infanticide, and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. Obviously, there would be a femicide.
Mm.
What's the masculine version of that?
Homicide?
Just straight up homicide. I suppose that would make sense. Mm. But, and I kind of... Like I said, over the last year or so, I kept saying, bringing up that podcast that I listened to that kind of...
Yeah.
Taught me a bit more about it. That's that Murder Most Irish podcast where they talk about mainly women getting killed. I mean, they had a couple of men getting killed in their stories, but they're big feminists.
Yeah,
they like to tell the female side of these things because most times it is
females
that end up on the receiving end of this. Because I said that to you doing the research, and it's creepy. We were sitting here only earlier today, and I was like, "Who's the person you trust the most in the fucking world?" And your answer was...
You.
And
I then had to point out, like, but statistically, I am the biggest danger to your life.
That you are.
Obviously not. But I mean, statistically, if you look at the statistics, it's nearly all.
Always somebody that's yeah. not. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have some statistics. I do. Some stuff up to say about femicide and statistics and stuff.
Femicide is broadly understood as the killing of women and girls by men. It differs from male homicide in specific ways, as most cases of femicide are committed by partners or ex-partners. It is a term used to describe killings of women and girls precisely because they are women and girls. Femicide is both a cause and result of gender inequality and discrimination, both of which are root causes of all violence against women.
So, I wonder, if the guy kills the girl for any other reason bar the fact that she's a girl, it's not femicide, it's homicide. Like, if you and me were to get into an argument and you end up dead in that argument, I didn't kill you because you were a woman, I killed you because of the argument we were having. Does that then make it homicide? But then if I turn around and like, I hate all women, and then started killing women, then is it femicide?
I'm not sure. I mean, the way that it's worded there is that it had to be either of the two, either gender inequality or discrimination.
Okay.
Both of which are root causes of all violence against women. So if you didn't kill me because I'm a woman specifically, then it would be because of gender inequality.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So femicide is often linked to ongoing emotional, physical, sexual, and economic abuse, including coercive control perpetrated by a partner or ex-partner against women. The understanding of femicide as the murder of a woman because of her gender is important. We know that although men are more likely to be the victims of homicide in general at the hands of a wide range of perpetrators, women who are murdered are highly likely to have been murdered by an intimate partner, ex-intimate partner, or family member.
Fucking hell.
In Ireland alone, 265 women have died violently between 1996 to the present. 20 children have died in incidents where women have died violently. 171 women have been killed in their own homes, so that's 63%. 87% of women where the case has been resolved were killed by a man known to them. 13% of women were killed by a stranger. One in every two femicide victims is killed by a current or former male intimate partner. Women of any age can be victims of femicide. However, women under the age of 35 make up 50% of the cases in Ireland. In almost all murder-suicide cases, which is about 23 out of 24, the killer was the woman's current or former male intimate partner. The rates of femicide drastically increased during the time of lockdown due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Around 50,000 women were murdered each year. So obviously that's worldwide, not just Ireland. This was due to the stay-at-home measures that increased the levels of isolation for women and girls. This became a life or death situation for women locked in with violent partners or relatives. That was something that I always thought about in lockdown. But, you know, I knew that we were safe. I knew that we were fine. But I was always, you know, like thinking of the people that, like, you know, like had oh, that yeah, kind of home. Like, it must have been horrifying. Yeah,
especially
yeah.
when maybe you're dealing with an alcoholic, where your refuge, your time, your safe time was when he was out of the house in the pub.
And now he's not out of the house and anymore. And
they're there with you all the time.
Like, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, that information comes from womensaid.ie. So, and apparently they do some good work. So you should be reading to that and helping them out. Do you think harsher laws would be, you know, implemented in the case of homicide would help the case, you know? I always thought it should be like a capital murder punishment. If you kill a cop or priest in Ireland, you get a maximum sentence of 40 years. It sounds soft to the Americans who hand out fucking 2,000 years at a time. You are going to have 6 life sentences, so you better fucking die, come back and start again, buddy. But our maximum is 40 years, and that is if you kill a cop or if you kill a priest.
It used to be the death sentence.
yeah. And again, but since we abolished death sentence, it is a 40-year sentence now. But I would value women over priests, personally. I would say you have a more important role in civilization. So I would think that the sentencing should be worse for killing a woman over a priest.
I definitely do think, because they harshened rape laws. Didn't they? When I was in college, I know that they did. They're still ridiculously lenient, but they did.
You see some people getting like 3 or 4 years for that kind of stuff, and when you kind of really think about it, it's like Right, it when they're going like, oh, 3 or 4 years, because it was one night of something bad you did.
But that's the but woman's that person's, life. Oh, that, yeah. That's something that's there in her life forever.
I always think of like when we did the Vanishing Triangle and we were talking about Larry Murphy's convicted attack, yeah. The one he's known for, the one he did, 100% we know.
Mm.
And the Sunday World covered it, and they kind of did a three-parter on it.
Yeah.
And they kind of went into detail on that part, like kind of played it out almost kind of like a dramatization, an audio dramatization of what was going on. So they were kind of playing your one in what was going on in her mind at the time. And I was thinking, he accosted her at her car. She was trying to get into her car. How is she ever going to walk alone across a fucking car park again to her car and feel safe? Like,
no, you know? Never. How are you going to take a
public,
long time.
Especially to happen in a public setting. How are you going to, you know,
want to leave the house?
Feel safe again.
Yeah.
You know, and that will kind of be in my mind is like, you're not going to, it's not just that one night with their relationships going forward with other men, their, you know, how they feel about sex in general after something like that, you know. You're taking something away from them for life, like, and this prick is only getting a couple of years in jail.
You see, I think when they changed the laws, there was some controversy around, their chance of like reoffending, and then the judges be like, well, you can't punish them for future crimes. I was like, you're not punishing them for future crimes. You're punishing them for what happened, and the sentence is lengthened based on their, you know, like their, like, I mean, like if you look at Larry Murphy.
Yeah. 10 years.
His sentence should have been lengthened because he did not make any fucking effort whatsoever to be rehabilitated.
If you enter an early guilty plea in Ireland, you'll do 5 years. And that's you'll get 5 years. You'll be out, I'd say 3.5.
You see, that's no goody. I don't agree with just because you've admitted to it, you're going to have a more lean. Well, you're saving the taxpayer money, and no, it's not a big long trial. It's
saving the
and the victim.
The victim from having to come up and relive the whole
thing. I would, telling you now, I would rather that it went to trial. Like,
but you know what? I think I would too. I think I'd like to sit in that dock. I would want to have my day in court. Got you, motherfucker. Yeah. You know, you are going down. Mm-hmm. Like. But it's not your choice. Once they plead guilty, there is no point in having a trial anymore. They plead guilty. They've admitted to it. It's over. You know.
I know it's very easy for me, but I genuinely think that, like, even the whole anonymity thing. I would want their name out there. I would want people to know. And I know it's shitty because you have to be named as well. Like,
but I think that stigma is kind of gone. That's an old stigma. Yeah, like, you know, I wouldn't look at someone and say, oh, there's such and such. They were raped and they were trained. You know?
Never.
I think, unfortunately, a lot of people would have from that, you know, because of the past era and all that stuff. I mean, all of us, we've all come across pedophiles and sexual fucking assaulters in our families and stuff like that. So we all know victims of that stuff in our family. And you don't look at them that way. You don't fucking judge them. And it's not like a tag on them. It's something that happened to them and then you move on.
It's not like you look at them and you're reminded every single time. Like it's
the person that committed the crime that you look at and you think, fuck that guy. Yeah. Fuck that person. You know? You don't really think of you think obviously, oh, the poor, that's a terrible thing that happened to them. But it's not something that you think every time you look at the person. You don't look at the person and say, well, that happened to them. It's not, you know, it doesn't register in your brain, especially when they've moved on. It's only if you see someone who's still maybe struggling with it, then it's like, oh, well, that's what
happened. This is what happened, yeah.
But, you know, that's going to happen regardless. But again, I suppose everybody's different. Everyone heals in a different way and everyone deals with it in a different way.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I would prefer in a case like that to get the motherfucker's name out there. Mm. So, because as we said, our fucking penalties are fairly lenient and they will be out again to reoffend soon. And if their name isn't out there, then people don't know their
And then
problem.
What happens in jail, as in like, I know that pedophiles need to watch their back in jail, but is it the same with rapists?
I would assume it depends on the scenario or your level of criminality, where you are on the crime ladder.
Okay.
I think if you're a gangster, at sick with guy, it'll just be kind of like, oh, fuck her, she deserved it, whatever. Mm.
But if you're a pedophile gangster, you're still
getting
stabbed.
And I do know that I have heard in certain situations that I know someone this has happened to. I don't know him properly, but I've heard a story about someone I knew that this happened to. Gangs use rape as a punishment against other men.
Yeah.
If you owe like big bad drug dealers money and they don't want to fucking kill you and to cause that problem, they'll to humiliate you, they will fucking rape you and abandon you. And it's kind of like that can happen to you again if you don't pay up next time, like, you know. So, or it'll be worse next time, you know. So, I mean, it's fucked up.
Yeah.
Really, really fucked up. But yeah, they need to, I think when it comes to something like that, I think the only way to deal with crimes like that is to make it extremely fucking, you know, the worst punishment possible, like, you know.
You castrate them.
Well, outside that, I mean, obviously, I know that's human not the rights
worst.
Fucking
that's not the worst. That, but I mean, like, but they've introduced that in some countries. In some countries, chemical castration is the punishment for paedophilia and stuff.
Should be a option to getting years knocked off your sentence.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
If you go in and you're like, I'm genuinely sorry for what I did, I'm getting counselling and I'm getting chemically castrated, then it's like, okay, now we can talk good behaviour and release. But outside that, it's you do your hard time, you do all of it. And I think like in the case of like the likes of Larry Murphy, where there was an attempted murder there as well.
Yeah.
10 years.
That's crazy.
Like Mark. I think I said it in a previous episode, but I feel attempted murder charges imprisonment or sentences should be the same as murder sentences, because essentially it's not a murder charge because you did it badly. You still had the mentality and want to kill. So why should you be getting off lighter just because you're shit at doing your job?
Yeah, sure.
Do you know?
Yeah.
You still had that in you to kill, so you should get a murder charge. It could be called attempted murder, but it should carry the same sentence.
But the life, I understand what you're saying, but legally a life hasn't been taken yet.
But you put the plan in place to take someone's life,
like,
meaning that you have the ability to do that and you could do that again.
No, I get it, but it's the whole concept again of, like what I said about the judges and the rape chart, as in not having the four, as in you can't for future.
Well, yeah, that's
what I'm saying about the rape charges.
But that's fine. You can't see into the future. Yeah. It's not Minority Report. What I'm saying here is this person attempted murder. This person premeditated killing this person. They just failed at doing it.
Mm.
The fact that someone's not dead is just because this person was bad at killing. They still had they still premeditated a murder. They still got prepared for a killing. So which means that's the same as murder. That should hold the same imprisonment time as murder. Just because you did it badly doesn't
I understand 100% what you're saying. What I'm saying is legally that's how they would look at it, is exactly what I was just saying about the
and people. That's why we got all this killing. Because you see, especially in these like femicide cases, these women are brutally beaten for years before they're eventually killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the guys keep getting released and keep going out. I don't know. I know there's that battered woman syndrome where they keep taking the guy back and keep kind of accept, which is shit too.
Yeah.
You think that I know. I don't know. Maybe just better facilities and all that put in place to help people in this in these situations. Or like I said, learn from this tale we are about to get into. So Dan Gallagher. He is a New York corporate lawyer and he is married to Beth Gallagher and they both have a 6-year-old daughter named Ellen.
Okay.
When Beth and Ellen leave town for what ends up to be an extended weekend, Dan falls into a sexual liaison with Alex Forrest, not Frost, a woman he has just met. She is a new associate editor at one of Dan's firm's clients' agencies, and as Alex knows about Dan's marital situation, Dan enters the liaison with an unspoken understanding that this is a no-strings-attached kind of thing, and that it'll all end at the end of the weekend when Beth and Ellen return home. But as the end of the weekend approaches, it becomes increasingly clear to Dan that Alex wants to continue the relationship. She uses different means to achieve her goals, including being passive-aggressive toward him and emotionally blackmailing him. Conversely, Dan wants to protect his current life that he has with Beth and Ellen, which means Beth not finding out about Alex. As Dan does whatever he can to dissuade Alex, she goes to more and more extremes to try and keep him. her actions, which may include harming herself and others, to keep Dan interested. But Dan is mostly interested in just protecting his wife and child and making sure to fuck that his wife does not find out about anything. Yes. Alex, on the other hand, is pretty intent on making sure that she will not be ignored. Patreon is alive, 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 alive. Patreon is alive, alive for our podcast. Patreon is alive, 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 alive. Patreon is alive, alive for our podcast. Hey kids, can't get enough of that blood, guts, and gore? Then head on over to our Patreon, where for just $5 a month, you'll get exclusive access to our true crime show, Real Monsters, and horrific history tales from Playing with Bones with Amy Rose, along with early access to our minisodes and ad-free access to everything else. All this and loads more horror-tastic extras from the Horrorverse. So what are you waiting for? Permission? Go nick your parents' card today and subscribe now at patreon.com/ It's Alive Alive Pod. Remember, that's It's Alive Alive Podcast, a really, really fake true crime horror podcast. It's Alive Alive, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt. So to counteract my terrible booking in this situation, we are going, you have some nice segments throughout where you are going to highlight some great women throughout time.
Yes.
Women who have made massive changes to humanity, who have helped humanity, who have done great things.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is a lot of, I was looking at the National Women's Museum website, and a lot of Americans in there, they didn't seem to go far.
Pretty sure an Irish woman invented bulletproof vests.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. We're getting into all that. So, as I said, anyway, to counteract my negative story, you're going to have a few positives thrown in here and there as we go about. So we'll get started. Dan Gallagher was born in 1948 and grew up in a middle-class home in the suburbs of New York City. A bright kid, finishing top of his class and receiving a full scholarship to Yale in 1965, graduating in 1970.
Does that happen in Ireland?
What?
You get straight A's and you got a full scholarship to like UCC or something.
You can do, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, straight A's. Do the college pay for it here or how does it work?
I have no idea in that regard,
but
there is definitely scholarships for like excellence in studies and for the same with sports and all that. You can get scholarships.
Well, I knew that with like sports, but I was just curious for like academic excellence. Do you like those colleges? Be like, right, we need her.
You have to remember the colleges, regardless of being here in the US, are going to be the same mentality. The smarter people in our school, the people who do the best. I mean, like if you're getting the guy who gets straight A's across the board, who's never, ever, ever failed a test outside of 100%, then he's going to go to your college or university. He's going to do the same. He's going to go on to do big things in some sort of job, and then he is an alumni of your university, meaning now more people come to your university, more funding comes to your university, and this man who has become extremely successful will start donating to this university.
I knew that. I knew how they worked. I was just wondering, do the college pay for them or how is it done?
I would assume different cases. I would assume colleges would have specific scholarships for people as well as the actual government itself.
But
I would assume the colleges. I don't know for sure, but I would have to assume they do.
Okay.
So after 10 years of busting his ass as a bit of a gopher and assistant, eventually Gallagher got to show his worth, and after paying his dues, began taking on major clients for one of the top US firms specializing in copyright laws, specifically publishing copyright laws. So he dealt with books, magazines, all that kind of shit.
Okay.
Making sure, you know, all that. Especially because you know yourself with books and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If it's autobiographical or if it is based on true events, sometimes people want their names left out, sometimes pseudonyms, sometimes people just... I mean, I know that in the case where he meets Alex Forrest, it was a problem with a politician who felt a story in this girl's book was too close to his actual relationship with her.
Okay.
Now, I would wonder why you'd make a big stink about that, because it was pretty much admitting that you are the man in the book that she is sleeping with.
Yep.
And you're trying to keep it hidden by screaming, "That's me in the book! Don't tell anybody! Take it out of the book! That's me in the book!"
Yeah, it's true, actually.
In his early years of practice, he met and fell in love with legal secretary Beth Archer, and the two eventually married, and in 1981, they welcomed their daughter Ellen into the family. Dan's career was in an upswing, and in turn, so was his bank account. So, with a daughter on the way, the couple bought their first apartment. Now, that seems a bit weird to Irish people, because we don't really buy apartments, we rent apartments. Yeah. Generally, you rent the apartment until you can afford the deposit for your mortgage to buy your house. But the American way seems a bit smarter. If you can afford it, fucking buy the apartment. Buy the apartment, so you're not filling your landlord's fucking pockets with... Your dead money. I mean, you know, at least you have something by the time it's over with, and then you can sell that to progress to your family home. So the apartment was always just a stop-off point until they could find their forever family home. You know, a proper place with a garden, safety, the city didn't provide for a growing child, that kind of stuff. Same reason we moved to the countryside.
Yeah.
The mentality of our kids could go outside and play without having to worry about... what might be roaming the fucking streets.
Yeah, exactly.
So after working hard, taking every available case and working long, long hours, Dan eventually saved the money required to finally get the home of their dreams. Home of their dreams being one very, very, very close to his wife's parents. So home of her dreams, most likely. So unlike my method of buying a house, the Gallaghers were a bit more diligent and spent months looking for their dream home. And for people who want to know what I mean by that is, Amy went home to her parents one time and came back and I had bought a house.
But do you not remember me showing you this house online?
Did you?
Yeah, I showed it to you twice and you were like, "I prefer this house." The one that we were in at the time. And I was like, "Well, that shut that down." And then I come back and this house is bought.
See, it was actually an elaborate surprise for you to say, "Surprise about the house you wanted."
Oh, thanks for telling me it was a surprise 10 years ago.
But yeah, I looked at no other house. I walked into this one. I was like, "Yeah, this will do. Here you go. Thank you." So they finally settled on a country house in Bedford, New York. As I said, close to her parents. And the house was pretty much everything they had ever wanted. It had land. It had, you know, nature. There was a swing for the kid there. There was, you know, it was everything. Especially because their daughter really, 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 really loved animals and was dying to get a rabbit.
Okay.
So they were, she was only allowed to get the rabbit after they moved to this place because they'd have the space for it. Because obviously a rabbit is not suitable for an apartment, as we also learned.
You could put them out on those, do you know, like they used to put the babies out in baby cages in the apartments. You could put your rabbit out in your baby cage if you had an old
scare
one.
Scare the shit out of it. Fucking hell, we had a rabbit and we didn't have much of a back garden, and it ate everything.
Books, my bags, everything. Yep. The wallpaper.
Everything.
I loved him.
Poor Finglas.
His name wasn't Finglas.
His name was Finglas. You gave up on it eventually.
It was my rabbit and you called it Finglas.
I didn't call it Finglas. Switzer called it Finglas. Right, well, you just all went with it. Anyway, Beth and Ellen decided to go and have a look at the house again. One more day. They were kind of on the fence about it, so we're going to have another look and, you know, do some measuring for curtains and the likes, and they were going to spend the weekend with her parents as well while they were at it.
Okay.
So this left Dan at home alone, because Dan actually had an appointment Saturday morning, a meeting. It was an emergency meeting. Again, as I said, it was about this politician who was a bit upset with a story in a book that was about to be published. They needed to get this solved quickly.
Okay.
Also at this meeting was Alex Forrest, who was the editor of this book. So that's why she was here. Now, this wasn't their first meeting. Alex and Dan had met at a party only, I think he said in his book about a week earlier or something like that. And he admits that he did get a bit flirtatious with her at the party. He was there with his wife and all, the dirty bastard. But apparently his mate was throwing eyes at Alex, who did not
like
reciprocate. And he chose to go with a bit of a smoother kind of thing, went up talking to her at the bar. Now, I will say this guy Dan, he is known to be a bit of a smooth talker. He's a solicitor. He's a lawyer. He's a smooth talker. He knows how to talk his way around it. But that being said, no other woman has come out against him saying that he slept with him, that he had any more affairs. He seems to have been at... I don't know a whole pile about him, but for what we do know, he doesn't have any legal problems. His wife never had an issue with him up until this point. He was a good father, a good husband, up until, a good provider up until this point. Whatever happened here, I don't know. And if it was his first time, I don't know. He seems very easygoing about the situation near the end for it to be like we say with serial killers, when they do it too well, sometimes you're kind of thinking maybe this isn't your first time, you know, like we say with Larry Murphy, just because the time he got caught, it all looked like a good setup, like someone who was learned in the ways of doing this. So maybe it's a similar case here, but we'll get into it. They met at a party, they got a bit flirty, but he did make it clear at the party that he was there with his wife.
Okay.
So at this meeting, she was well aware again that he was a married man, and it was just a normal meeting. They were going through some stuff they were dealing with afterwards. He went outside. He said it was pissing rain. Couldn't get a taxi. Couldn't get his umbrella to work.
Okay.
Hate that fucking shit. When you're trying to get your umbrella open, then it flips up and open the other way, and you're there trying to fucking fix it. And he said that Alex spotted him, came over and tried and basically put her umbrella over him, and, you know, they tried to hail a cab together. I couldn't get a cab, so he asked her, did she want to go for a drink?
Okay.
Which, again, seems tame enough. Yeah. I mean, work colleagues. She's saying, fine, don't throw me eyes. She would be pissed the fuck off. Anyway.
What have you... Why are you paying... How that one mystifies me. Why you'd say that? I'd be pissed off.
Would you not be pissed off if I can't?
Depends on the situation. Yeah, you know me. You're with me ten years. In what situation can you see me being pissed off with that? Unless you're like, oh, I met this girl on the street today, and she asked me to go for a drink, so I went to a drink with her, and she's a complete stranger.
To be fair,
that's weird.
And to be fair, that one time that girl hitting me, I came like straight home, like you were like, this girl hitting me, Amy.
That was a girl.
Anyway, so he goes off for a drink with this girl, with Alex.
Yeah.
And one thing leads to another, and they're out for the day drinking. Okay. And then one thing leads to another, and they are doing the dirty. So, asshole, definitely. But, I mean, at this point, seems like just a stupid fling that he should be, you know, feel bad for and go home, you know? How do I word this? We were talking about this the last day when we were researching this. And I was like, what mystifies me is, because we're about to get into it, he spends the weekend with her. And I said to you, I just don't understand how the guilt doesn't come into it. Because I was like, if that was me in that situation, no matter how fogged up my brain is, as soon as I came, it would be like, oh shit, I'm a scumbag. Get the fuck out of my house. Do you know? Like, you need to leave. Yeah. It'll be like instant guilt. But this guy, anyway, as I just kind of alluded to, they spent the weekend together. They slept together the first night. They spent the entire night together. And then Alex suggests that they go out dancing the next night, which, again, Dan agrees to do.
Okay.
So Dan goes out dancing with her. Now, in Dan's mind at this point, it seems like he was pretty sure that she understood he was married. The wife was away for the weekend. That this was just a fling. They were just going to have a bit of fun over the weekend. And after that, it was all done. End of. See you later. We'll never talk again.
Okay.
Alex had other ideas. So when Sunday came and it was time for Dan to go home... Alex started to freak out at him, and they got into a bit of a fight. Now, Dan claims that he was just about to get to the door to leave when he heard Alex crying and saw her walking towards him with her wrists bloodied. So that is red flag number one. Because me and you were talking about this as well, and that is a very common teenage thing for people to deal with. You dealt with this.
I dealt with this.
I'll kill myself if you leave me.
I only missed a fucking bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was common.
So you hadn't broken up with him.
I hadn't broken up with him. But it was a thing.
You were just late.
I was supposed to get the bus too, because he lived a bit away from me. And I slept in and I missed the bus. And that's not like me. You know me. Like, I don't sleep. If I know I have to get up for a bus, but I'd been with my friends the night before. Like, I was 16 and I missed the bus. So I rang him and I was like, hi, I missed the bus. Like, we'll have to do it like next weekend because obviously school in between. And he just started freaking out. Saying that if I broke up with him, that he would, you know, like, top himself. But then his parents got involved. They rang my parents and they were all like, oh, we're afraid to leave our house to go to work. And my mom was like, shit. Well, that's the problem you have with our child. What do you want us to do about it?
So instead of this guy going, okay, no problem, let's just talk on the phone and we can text all week and I'll see you next weekend. And you wouldn't have broken up with him. He freaked out that you were going to break up with him, causing you to break up with him.
Causing me to break up with him. And then when I did do that, because I was 16, the last thing I got from him was, fuck you and fuck your pathetic life, you fucking whore. I was like, ooh, that turned to rage. He went through the stages quickly. My dad cheered me up by saying, it's okay, you're not that lovable.
Oh, dickhead.
No, not my dad.
Not your dad. Go, fucking asshole. And you know, I think your brother said he dealt with something similar as well. I feel like I never dealt with that. No girl was willing to kill herself for me.
It's weird. But of all the things that would have said to me, I need to break up with this person now for everybody's sake. That was going to be it.
Well, that's it. Those kind of signs kind of come up in the figure. The only kind of experience I had of that was like when I was, you know, I was only about 14, 15.
Yeah.
And I was going out with a girl for like, I don't know, a couple of weeks.
Mm.
And then we broke up. Do you know these stupid kind of kid fucking relationships? And every day at lunchtime, she knew that like we used to come out, me and, because we were the, you know, the got metalhead kind of guys, and we wouldn't go out the front door and walk down the normal road like everybody else. We jumped over a back wall into an alleyway that led to the girls' school. So we go over and we get to check out the girls and then go down and get our food.
Yeah.
And we come back the same way too. But she knew we'd do that. So we'd jump over the wall, but she'd be down the other end of the alleyway watching, and one of her friends would be waiting for me for when I jumped over the wall to ask me, oh, come on, any chance you go back with her? Anything? But every day she'd be like, I could see her peeping behind the wall to see if I was there and all that. I was like, cute for you, fucking scared the shit out of me.
Oh, we had guys like that as well. Not me personally, but one of my friends, this was just constant turning up, as in like presents being thrown at her. I think he was even telling the friends at one stage that he was going to get the ride off her, like. You know, but this was like for 17, 18. It was this guy
sounds like he might have gotten this from Alex Frost, because we're going to get into more about that. But yeah, she does try to kill her. Well, she, I think it's not really a real attempt at killing herself here, because he was able to stop the bleeding fairly quick, according to him. Dan Gallagher himself said he could stop the bleeding pretty quick. He calmed her down, bandaged her up, cuddled her, and called for an ambulance and got her to hospital. Okay. Now, when we were talking about this, you said that maybe he was leading her on a bit by cuddling into her a bit too much, and maybe he should have been a bit colder towards her in the situation.
And I would also point out that if this did happen, whatever about the fact that you had slept with her at this stage, I would be more pissed off at the fact that you stayed and comforted her because she didn't want you to leave.
Yeah.
That's,
but I say you're probably right in that situation. Like, if it was me, again, I hate to keep putting myself in this position because I feel like I've done something wrong now.
I'm going to wake up so angry with you in the morning.
That it would be a case of she could have been like, stop the bleeding, call the ambulance and leave.
Well, that's
and
what I'd have like, done in that situation. Yeah, like, call the ambulance and
I
go.
Might even start acting a bit dickish about it so that she will stop liking me. And you know. But again, no, I mean, like in this story, and that's the one thing I would point out right now, nobody's right in this story. No. There's no good people in this story, except poor Beth. Beth does nothing wrong.
But I wouldn't even think that I was medically trained enough to help someone that had done that. Like, I would be constantly thinking
the fucking,
they are going to bleed out if I don't call this ambulance. Yeah. Like, and I wouldn't be able to.
I think now would be a good time for one of your uplifting segments, maybe. So who do you got for us first? Who's our first influential woman here?
First up is Hedy Lamarr. And I can tell you now, you'd all be curled up in the fetal position on the floor, because without her, you wouldn't have your Wi-Fi. So this segment is from the National Women's History Museum.
And I'm telling you now, if you got your Wi-Fi, go look up Hedy Lamarr.
Oh, she's a stunner. Yeah. But apart from that, Hedy Lamarr was an Austrian-American actress and inventor who pioneered the technology that would one day form the basis for today's Wi-Fi, GPS, and Bluetooth communication systems. As a natural beauty seen widely on the big screen in films like Samson and Delilah and White Cargo, society has long ignored her inventive genius. Lamarr was originally Hedwig Eva Kiesler, born in Vienna, Austria on November 9th, 1914, into a well-to-do Jewish family.
I'm just going to say no. Good choice in the name change.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely. An only child, Lamarr received a great deal of attention from her father, a bank director and a curious man who inspired her to look at the world with open eyes. He would often take her for long walks where he would discuss the inner workings of different machines like the printing press or streetcars. These conversations guided Lamar's thinking, and at only 5 years of age, she could be found taking apart and reassembling her music box to understand how the machine operated. Meanwhile, Lamar's mother was a concert pianist and introduced her to the arts, placing her in both ballet and piano lessons from a young age. Lamar's brilliant mind was ignored, and her beauty took center stage when she was discovered by director Max Reinhardt at the age of 16. She studied acting with Reinhardt in Berlin and was in her first small film role by 1930 in a German film called Geld after Strafe, maybe? Money on the Street. However, it wasn't until 1932 that Lamarr gained name recognition as an actress for her role in the controversial film Ecstasy.
Whoa, well, that's controversial.
I would think it's pretty cool. 1932, is that still pre-Hays Code?
Not too
when
sure.
When was Frankenstein first? What year was Frankenstein? Is that
1932?
Well, then Ecstasy would be pre-cold. If it was out in 1932 is what I'm thinking. If it was out before Frankenstein. Are you looking it up?
But I'm spelling Ecstasy wrong. No, I'm not. Actually, what's her first name again?
Hedy.
Hedy
Lamarr.
Romance drama. Czech erotic.
Ooh.
Romantic drama. A film is about a young woman who marries a wealthy but much older man. After abandoning her brief passionless marriage, she meets a young virile engineer who becomes her lover. Ecstasy was filmed in three language versions, German, Czech and French. It is perhaps the first non-pornographic movie to portray sexual intercourse and female orgasm, although never showing more than the actors' faces.
Okay.
So that was, what, 1933? Oh, fucking hell. That's progressive for its time.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Hays Code was 1934, so it just got in there before it wasn't allowed to be shown. Anyway, Austrian munitions dealer Fritz Mandl became one of Lamar's adoring fans when he saw her in the play Sissy. Lamarr and Mandl married in 1933, but it was short-lived. She once said, "I knew very soon that I could never be an actress while I was his wife. He was the absolute monarch in his marriage. I was like a doll. I was like a thing, some object of art which had to be guided and imprisoned, having no mind, no life of its own." She was incredibly unhappy as she was forced to play host and smile on demand among Mandel's friends and scandalous business partners, some of whom were associated with the Nazi party. She escaped from Mandel's grasp in 1937 by fleeing to London, but took with her the knowledge gained from dinner table conversation over wartime weaponry.
Ooh, smart. Yeah, I mean, even there where you hear, like, being treated like a doll, you listen to her early life, there's no way a woman like that's going to be happy playing fucking host.
No, absolutely not. No,
you know?
No. She's too great a mind.
She's the kind of woman who wants to be out in the garage taking the car apart.
Oh, yeah. Back together. There's not wrong with her taking care of herself as well. Like,
do you know you? Yeah, it's like if ever there has been like a near perfect person,
that's
it seems
Lamarr,
like
right?
It's her. She's smart, she's good looking, mm-hmm. She's well able to fucking do whatever she fucking wants.
Absolutely.
Take things
knows her own mind. Yeah.
Do you know, it seems extremely, definitely someone women could aspire to
extremely
be like.
Independent,
you know?
Yeah. So while in London, Lamarr's luck took a turn when she was introduced to Louis B. Mayer. Do you say Louis B. Mayer? It's Louis Mayer, isn't it? I'm going to go with Louis. A famed MGM Studios. With this meeting, she secured her ticket to Hollywood, where she mystified American audiences with her grace, beauty, and accent. In Hollywood, Lamar was introduced to a variety of quirky real-life characters, such as businessman and pilot Howard Hughes. Lamar dated Hughes, but was most notably interested with his desire for innovation. Her scientific mind had been bottled up by Hollywood, but Hughes helped to fuel the innovator in Lamar, giving her a small set of equipment to use in her trailer on set. While she had an inventing table set up in her house, the small set allowed Lamar to work on inventions between takes. Hughes took her to his airplane factories, showed her how the planes were built, and introduced her to the scientists behind the process. Lamar was inspired to innovate as Hughes wanted to create faster planes that could be sold to the US military. She bought a book of fish and a book of birds and looked at the fastest of each kind. She combined the fins of the fastest fish and the wings of the fastest bird to sketch a new wing design for Hughes' plane. Upon showing the design to Hughes, he said to Lamar, "You're a genius." Lamar was indeed a genius as the gears in her inventive mind continued to turn. She once said, "Improving things comes naturally to me." She went on to create an upgraded stoplight and a tablet that dissolved in water to make a soda similar to Coca-Cola. However, her most significant invention was engineered as the United States geared up to enter World War II. In 1940, Lamar met George Antheil at a dinner party. George was another quirky yet clever force to be reckoned with. Known for his writing, film scores, and experimental music compositions, he shared the same inventive spirit as Lamar. She and George talked about a variety of topics, but of their greatest concerns was the looming war. George recalled, "Hetty said that she did not feel very comfortable sitting there in Hollywood and making lots of money when things were in such a state." After her marriage to Mandel, she had knowledge on munitions and various weaponry that would prove beneficial. And so Lamar and George began to tinker with ideas to combat the Axis power.
Was she an Oppenheimer by any chance? Did they mention her an Oppenheimer?
Let me check this really quick. Hetty Lamar.
Yeah, we've just seen that movie and I can't remember. Any mention of her?
No.
Strange one. It's just they'd be bored at the same time and wouldn't.
Oh, not mention her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did these two come up with?
So the two came up with an extraordinary new communication system used with the intention of guiding torpedoes to their targets in war. The system involved the use of frequency hopping among radio waves, with both transmitter and receiver hopping to new frequencies together. Doing so prevented the interception of the radio waves, thereby allowing the torpedo to find its intended target. After its creation, Lamar and George sought a patent and military support for the invention. While awarded US patent number 2292387 in August of 1942, the Navy decided against the implementation of the new system. The rejection led Lamar to instead support the war efforts with her celebrity by selling war bonds. Happy in her adopted country, she became an American citizen in April 1953.
So they ignored her fucking smarts for her fucking looks.
They ignored her and made her sell war bonds like your man in the Pacific.
Yeah, that's fucking bullshit. It's like taking Sheldon Cooper and being like, "Yeah, it's okay, just go there and sell shit for us."
To be honest, when I was reading that sentence, how I thought it was going to be the rejection led Lamar to instead support the Axis. Anyway, meanwhile, Lamar's patent expired before she ever saw a penny from it. While she continued to accumulate credits in films until 1958, her inventive genius was yet to be recognized by the public. It wasn't until Lamar's later years that she received any awards even for her invention. The Electronic Frontier Foundation jointly awarded Lamar and George with their Pioneer Award in 1997. Lamar also became the first woman to receive the Invention Convention's Bulby Nass Spirit of Achievement Award.
Some fucking mouthful there.
Isn't it? Although she died in 2000, Lamar was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame for the development of her frequency hopping technology in 2014. Such achievement has led Lamar to be dubbed the mother of Wi-Fi and other wireless communications like GPS and Bluetooth.
So essentially, while she was good looking, young and good looking, they ignored her. And then she got older, they lost interest in her looks and it was like, "Oh, look, she's smart."
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks. But she is remembered now as being, and look at what we fucking have because of
it. Because of her.
Exactly. You and me wouldn't be doing this right now if it wasn't for it.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. Do you think so? We'd have to be doing it on dial-up.
We'd be taping it and fucking putting it on pirate radio. Yeah. But again, radio, would yeah.
Taping it, leaving the tapes in places, bus stations.
No, definitely. I remember as a kid wanting to be a pirate radio host. Like, so I mean, this is kind of.
Is it because pirate could be in the name of your profession?
No, I just like the idea. You know me, I like the idea of being the kind of the outlaw in situations like that. Not the criminal outlaw, but it was the same when I was in the bike clubs and stuff like that. It's that status of kind of being. Kind of your own law in a way, but still having enough morals to do decent shit and be a decent person. But I always thought it'd be fun. It was like the idea of working on a radio station, blah, boring. The idea of being a fucking secret radio station where you get to say and do whatever you want, that's fun.
You know? Yeah, I can see it.
Being in control, being into, you know, it's just, I don't know. Now everybody can do it, so.
Where's the fun?
But they won't let us play the music, so I mean, you know, I still think I have a good idea for that in the future.
Yeah?
My idea in the future is to maybe do a music show where we invite local bands to submit their music to us. And our radio show will be just indie bands, independent unsigned bands who give us their music to play. So we don't have to worry about royalties. Yeah. We get exposure and we can have a radio show. And I don't know, maybe we might do that in the future. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
We'll have a look into it.
But yeah. And then we can be real pirate radio station hosts.
Never.
All right. So that was a nice break from the crazy. So let's get back into the crazy. Yeah, that was a pretty cool story, to be honest. I didn't know that much about her, and we were just talking off mic there, and it seems like I was saying to you,
she was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I was like, was she a bitch or something? There has to be some flaw there somewhere with this woman, but she seems like she was an all around perfect woman.
Yep. Maybe she false teeth.
Maybe she couldn't cook or something. I don't know. Or is that a stereotype? Am I going to get in trouble for that now as well?
She seems like an all rounder, to be honest. I wonder if she could sing. Maybe that's...
Look up her movies, I don't know. Anyway, we get back to poor Alex Frost. Forrest! God damn it, Forrest!
You look like you thought about that and all and just decided not fuck it, it's Forrest.
Maybe it's because she was a bit of a frosty bitch, I don't know.
She was anything but a frosty bitch.
I suppose so, yeah. I've seen pictures of her. She looks like she could be a bit frosty.
I'm not going to say who she reminds me of.
Her in this episode. Anyway, Alex was born to a wealthy family in 1951. Alex was particularly close to her father, who was said to be a little manipulative.
How was he manipulative of her?
Well, he used to be a bit... If she didn't meet his standards, he could be a bit cold towards her. And he had pretty high standards for his daughter. On top of that, he used to use her... He used to use daddy-daughter outings as an excuse to go meet women and have affairs.
Is that what the Green River Killer did, but with prostitutes?
Yep.
Okay.
The Green River Killer Gary Ridgway, used to bring his 8-year-old son along in the car, I think from toddler up to 8 years old, along in the car when he picked up a hooker, so that the hooker would feel more comfortable knowing that, obviously, if you see a child in the car, you don't think he's going to kill you.
That poor boy.
And then he would drive him out to the woods and he'd be like, oh, look, obviously the kid's in the car. Let's go into the woods to do this. He'd go into the woods with the girl and would come out alone.
Did his son say what he used to say he did with them?
Well, the kid was only young. He didn't.
Ace? You'd know when.
I think eight. I don't know why eight popped into my head. That could be really wrong.
Oh.
It was definitely just he bought his son. It was a toddler. Eight pops into my head for some reason. I don't know why. But he used to use the child to basically put the girl at ease and then strike. So, basically what he was doing here, though, was trying more to fool his wife than it was to put the girl at ease.
Yeah.
If he's out with his daughter, he couldn't possibly be out with another woman. And then he would kind of manipulate Alex into lying for him, covering for him.
Yeah.
You know? Obviously, this would have an effect on Alex going forward, as we learn here.
Definitely.
After college, Alex became an extremely successful editor with a publishing company. She was seen as a very capable and motivated woman whose workplace behavior has never hinted at any degree of dysfunction or instability. So, for people, because we'll get to the trial eventually, but for people around Alex, this is out of the ordinary. So, I mean, I've been telling this story as if she is a 100% guaranteed loon, but we have, like, really only two people here who are accusing her of being an absolute lunatic. Everybody else that has known Alex or been around Alex has said she's been a pretty stable and decent person who is career-driven.
Do you think any eligible men that did know her, though, knew not to... Well, don't fuck with
Alex. Stay away from her. So like I said, this, according to everyone that knows her, this suicide attempt was the first sign of any instability in Alex. So I suppose, yeah, when we say, like, you know, maybe Dan and Beth are the only ones to see her be crazy, this is on record that she was in hospital for slashing at her wrists. And it wasn't very deep slashes. It was seen to be more of a cry for help than an actual attempt.
Yeah.
So Dan first says he tried to put this out of his mind. Tried to forget about it, tried to move on with his life. It was a fling, it needed to be in the past, but his conscience got the better of him and he had to check on Alex just to make sure that she was okay.
Of course he did. Leading her out again.
Well, that's it. He went to the hospital to see her. No, when he went to the hospital, he was going there as well to clear the air. He wanted to make sure that she understood, because of the kind of breakdown it was, and because it was a breakdown because he was leaving, he was afraid there was an attachment there. No, he wanted to make sure that he could make it clear to her, it was a fling. It's over. It ain't going to happen again. I made a mistake.
Do you know what would make it more clear to her, more clearer than visiting her in the hospital?
What?
Not visiting her in the hospital.
And you would see, he says that at the time she was very, very calm, very lucid, and she just said, yeah, okay, I understand. It's not a big deal. She offered to take him out again, all right, at the same time as he was telling her nothing else could happen. But she said it was his friends, just as a kind of peace offering, and for her,
because
as
she
an
decided to play the long game.
Yeah. Apology for what she had done, basically, is what she was saying, and he turned her down.
Okay.
He said, no, I don't want to lead you on. There is no more relationship. This is it. We're done.
Okay.
So that was fine, but Alex did see it as a sign of affection and care that he did come to check on her. And she believed that it was the fact that Dan was a good man and didn't want to disappoint and leave his wife and family behind to go off with her.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, she starts to pursue Dan. She basically thinks he's playing hard to get. And Dan says he's showing up to work and on a number of occasions, and she's in the waiting room waiting for him. So he brought her into the waiting room one day, he said, and he made it as clear as day to her. He said, as clear as possible, to the point where he was a bit of a dick. And said, there is nothing here. Fuck off. Do not contact me again.
Yeah, yeah.
That's when he said the phone calls started. Okay. And that she was ringing the office looking for him, trying to get appointments with him, trying to schedule time to talk to him. And he was obviously getting his secretary to give her the brush off every time.
Okay.
So, do you think that stopped her? What do you think the next step is? If he's not answering his phone at work, she starts to ring home.
Shit, start.
No, she was not, and this is creepy as fuck, but she's ringing, and if he answers, she'll talk. If the wife answers, she goes quiet. Beth says, like, at the time, she was answering the phone, like, yeah, like 5-6 times a day to just keep breathing. So she was starting to get freaked out by it.
Yeah.
And it was freaking them out enough that they changed her number.
Okay.
This pissed Alex off no end, apparently, because she made contact with Dan again and they arranged a meeting.
Okay.
And Dan was determined this time that this meeting was going to be it. He had to change his number. Yeah. He was about to move house. He was starting his new life with his family in their new home.
Yeah.
He wanted to be done with this shit.
Yeah.
But when he met Alex, She dropped the bombshell that she was. What does every crazy lady say when she wants to keep a man?
I'm got pregnant.
What? So she told, and I've never gotten I can't find confirmation on this. I don't know. There's nothing in the autopsy report or anything like that, but we don't know if she actually was pregnant, but she claimed to be pregnant.
Okay.
But she told Dan that she had no problem with them needing separate lives and that she would take care of the child herself and he didn't have to have anything to do with it. Obviously, Dan wanted the abortion, do you know?
Oh, well, yeah.
She was, no, it's cool. I'll do it myself. Don't you worry about it.
Do what herself?
Take care of the child herself.
Okay.
Not give herself an abortion. It's just. But he insists that this is it. There is no more. You got to stop fucking calling my house. You got to stop fucking leaving messages. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want my wife to find out. I'm happy. It was a mistake. This will never happen again.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the thought process here, according to Dan, for Alex, was like, Dan insisted at this meeting that he was happily married. Alex, on the other hand, took it as, you couldn't be happily married. You slept with me. If you were happily married, you wouldn't have been out looking for someone else. You wouldn't have slept with somebody else.
Yeah.
Now, he is screaming or insisting, this was a fling, a mistake. It shouldn't have fucking happened.
Moment. It went on for a whole weekend. Fuck this guy.
Yeah, I suppose. But basically, anyway, this meeting, by the time it was all said and done, Dan was telling her to fuck off or he will kill her. And she was screaming that she will not be ignored. So, yeah, things are going well in that respect.
Yep. What I think we need to get some more female positivity in here. So our last segment focused on the creator of Wi-Fi, and our next great woman is the Nobel Prize winning physicist and chemist Marie Curie, who was born in Warsaw on November the 7th, 1867, the daughter of a secondary school teacher. She received a general education in local schools and some scientific training from her father. She became involved in the Students' Revolutionary Organization and found it prudent to leave Warsaw, then in the part of Poland dominated by Russia, for Krakow.
Do you know, I don't know why, but for some reason I always thought her name was Madame Curie. I don't know why, to be honest with you.
Well, if she moved to France, she would be Madame Curie.
I don't know. Who does the wax work?
That's Madame Tussauds.
I used to get mixed up between the two all the time.
Oh.
I was like, what? The person who did waxworks also did physics? What? But yeah, I used to get it all mixed up. I don't know why. Even this evening when we were like putting this together and you were like, Marie Curie. Mm-hmm. I was like, but Madame, get what?
Was like, okay. There'd be about, wrong. I think, maybe about 100 years between them.
Anyway, go for it.
So anyway, in 1891, she went to Paris to continue her studies, where she became Madame Curie, to continue her studies at the Sorbonne, where she obtained licentiateships in physics and the mathematical sciences. She met Pierre Curie, professor in the School of Physics, in 1894, and in the following year, they were married. She succeeded her husband as head of the physics laboratory at the Sorbonne, gained her Doctor of Science degree in 1903, and following the tragic death of Pierre Curie in 1906, she took his place as Professor of General Physics in the Faculty of Sciences, the first time a woman had held this position.
I would have thought that very, very early for a woman to be getting that kind of position, in a, especially a married woman to be continuing on in that kind of work.
Well, at this stage, she wasn't married anymore because Pierre had died.
But she was married while she was still working there.
But it also helped.
She surpassed her husband in what she was doing.
Oh, yeah. I think, I think at that time, considering her field, it probably helped her cause to be able to further.
There wouldn't have been as many physicists and chemists at it, or...
Well, no, because if I mean, like, at that time, you're a woman and you're good, the only way you're going to get noticed, what I'm thinking is, you have a male relative, or she has her husband, and they're
husband,
there.
If the husband's back at her, then she's probably okay to keep working. That, he's like, oh yeah, work with me, it's cool.
Yes, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
In that kind of view, I, like, I, not I, to yeah, take it
yeah,
away from
yeah,
her.
No, I understand what you mean.
It, yeah. It is. So she was also appointed director of the Curie Laboratory in the Radium Institute of the University of Paris, founded in 1914. Her early researchers, together with her husband, were often performed under difficult conditions. Laboratory arrangements were poor and both had to undertake much teaching to earn a livelihood. The discovery of radioactivity by Henri Becquerel in 1896 inspired the Curies in their brilliant researches and analysis, which led to the isolation of polonium, named after the country of Marie's birth, and radium. Madame Curie developed methods for the separation of radium from radioactive residues in sufficient quantities to allow for its characterization and the careful study of its properties, therapeutic properties in particular. So she obviously did become Madame Curie.
Yeah, I just saw that myself. See? I'm like, yes, I knew I heard that somewhere.
That's why I said to you, when she went to France, she became it. So Madame Curie, throughout her life, activity promoted the use of radium to alleviate suffering. And during World War I, assisted by her daughter Irene, she personally devoted herself to this remedial work. She retained her enthusiasm for science throughout her life and did much to establish a radioactivity laboratory in her native city. In 1929, President Hoover of the United States presented her with a gift of $50,000 donated by the American Friends of Science to purchase radium for use in the laboratory in Warsaw. Sometimes I say laboratory, other times I say laboratory. I think it's from Pinky in the Brain.
When I was doing the Herbert West thing, I don't know why, but laboratory just felt right every time I said it.
I feel like I need to put on like a laboratory.
Laboratory.
Madame Curie, quite dignified and unassuming, was held in high esteem and admiration by scientists throughout the world. She was a member of the Conseil de Physique Solvay from 1911 until her death, and since 1922 she had been a member of the Committee of Intellectual Cooperation of the League of Nations. Her work is recorded in numerous papers in scientific journals, and she is the author of Recherche sur la substance radioactive in 1904, L'isotopie et les éléments. No, do you know what? I'm not even going to try.
The researches one just sounded like you couldn't pronounce research.
Research. There was two French papers, one published in 1904 and one in 1910. She wrote them both in their class. Yeah. Check them out. The importance of Madame Curie's work is reflected in the numerous awards bestowed on her. She received many honorary science, medicine, and law degrees and honorary memberships of learned science societies throughout the world. Together with her husband, she was awarded half of the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1903 for their study into spontaneous radiation discovered by Becquerel, who was awarded the other half of the prize. In 1911, she received a second Nobel Prize, this time in chemistry, in recognition of her work in radioactivity. She also received, jointly with her husband, the Davy Medal of the Royal Society in 1903, and in 1921, President Harding of the United States, on behalf of the Women of America, presented her with 1 gram of radium in recognition of her service to science.
Is this woman not the woman that is really radioactive?
So both, Pierre actually, I'm pretty sure, died from his exposure to radioactive substances. The two of them are buried together in a lead-lined coffins because they're so radioactive. People, they can wear protection to research her journals and her diaries and all that, but you and I couldn't sit here with one in front of us.
We were like a full hazmat suit.
Oh, yeah. All her stuff is still radioactive.
Mental.
Yeah.
What age she survived till?
She died of epileptic anemia. I need to check the year. Can you check the year there? So she died of epileptic anemia. So that would be linked to a lot of cancers that would be caused by, you know, radioactive substances. So kind of a
shit one. She was 66.
66, but it definitely shortened her lifespan.
Oh, yeah. With 66 in 1934, you're bad either. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder what you can do with 1 gram of radium.
I have no idea. And it's her gravesite is basically like a mini Chernobyl. No, you just can't. Can people go and visit it? Or
lead lined. So Superman couldn't see the bomb through it, so nothing getting through that.
So it could be her body. Or it could be Lex Luthor's hidden stash of weaponry and gold and other objects. Sort of.
Yeah.
See, it's all just a big conspiracy to keep Superman from finding the real stuff. Yep. Good stuff. Good job, Lex. Good job.
Okay, it's honesty time. We have a confession to make. We suck at socials. No good at Insta. Can't send a tweet or an X or whatever that super villain looking motherfucker is calling it now. Stick to your space cars, Elon. But we know you want to chat. You want to be kept updated. You want to be alive all the goddamn time. So we're getting down from the anti-social soapbox and giving this a try. So come chat to us on Insta and Twitter at AliveAlivePod or hit us up by email at itsAliveAlivePod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. This is a project. It's still a work in progress and we just want to give you more what you like and less of what you can't stand. So give us a like, give us a follow. We'll always hit you back and we'll always try to reply to everyone. So come say hi. We don't bite. Well, at least Amy doesn't. And she keeps me well fed, so you got nothing to worry about. Now, back to the show.
So, needless to say, after that meeting, things did not get any better for the Gallagher family. And Alex was more determined than ever to win Dan away from Beth. Her tactic? Do the craziest shit possible.
That she hasn't already done.
Oh, she is about to up the level of crazy big time. Have you ever done anything crazy to try and win someone back? Even something small crazy to try and win someone back?
No.
No, me neither.
No, no, just, I think that. Like, have I? No.
Nah. Not really.
Define crazy. I'm joking. No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, the first thing Alex did to try and win Dan back was cover his gorgeous Lexus. Oh, I think it was a Lexus, he said, with acid.
With acid? Where did she get the acid from?
I couldn't fucking tell you. Where do any of these fucking crazy people find any of this crazy shit? We've covered killers who were getting acid fucking vats to put their fucking bodies into. This fucking surprises you. I mean, apparently Americans can just buy acid whenever, wherever, however. It doesn't make a difference. You don't need an excuse for it.
Bonkers.
Anyway, Dan came out one day from work to his car spot. Obviously, big posh lawyer has his own little space. To find his car smoking. Not in a good way. The entire fucking bonnet was melting away as it was being eaten by some sort of acidic liquid. Now, again, there is no proof, 100% proof this was Alex. But it was Alex.
Okay. Definitely Alex.
He went straight to the police. Basically, he said at this point he was still really embarrassed about the situation, so he wouldn't tell the police it was him. And being a lawyer, he was like, I have a client who this is happening to. What can we do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you go essentially threaten this woman and tell her to stop? And the cop, being a good cop, said no.
No, you can't threaten her.
But they'd investigated the car and all that kind of job. This is the 80s. They have no fucking cameras in those car parks. So no.
Do they not?
Not yet.
I don't know when CCTV came in. Like,
not widespread. I mean, like, the factory I work in apparently didn't have cameras up until about 2 or 3 years ago. Like, do you know? And yeah, they only got it in because there was a fire in the factory. You
know, oh, okay.
Before that, they didn't have
it.
So, and that's a factory where people could get hurt and you need to be able to see things.
Yeah,
see what's going on.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the meantime, with all this crazy shit happening, Dan decided to push forward with the move to try and get the family out of New York City and out to Bedford where they could put a bit of distance between the family and
Alex.
Okay. He came home one day to find Alex sitting in his sitting room. Talking to his wife.
The balls.
Something about, I think she was pretending to be an interior decorator or something. She was discussing paint with the wife, which freaked Dan out.
Yeah,
he put her aside, tried to tell her, you can't be coming here. Essentially went to her house and threatened her again and told her, you know, I know, and it seems very repetitive. He's making a lot of threats. He's going to the police. I think when we were covering this as well, you said to me, I understand why Americans get hitmen now. Yeah. Because this woman was not going to give up. And this guy seemed like he was out of options. No, he bought it all on himself. But he was kind of getting to the point where he's all out of options.
An old backhand joke.
No, remember we say that when they moved to this lovely house in the country, they promised Ellen she could get herself a nice little bunny rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they got Ellen her nice little bunny rabbit. And one day they came home, not long after this time where Alex had been in their house, they came home, Beth came home to find this nice little bunny rabbit boiling in a big, whatchamacallit, basically stew fucking
stew pot.
Yeah, on the stove. You ever hear the term bunny boiler?
Yep.
When they talk about crazy women? Yep. This is who what they're talking about. This comes from this case. Alex Frost, the bunny boiler.
Oh, so that's not a compliment.
No, it is not a compliment. I'm joking. At this point, Dan realized he was beat.
Okay.
And Dan finally manned up, put on his big boy pants, and confessed to his wife what he had done. He saw the threat that was ahead of him, in front of
him. Yeah, in fairness, he manned up a wee bit.
He had to, you know, it was for his family's safety, he had to man up and tell her what had happened.
What happened, yeah.
Obviously, she didn't take it too fucking well, and he was sleeping on the couch for a few nights.
Mm.
But they didn't definitively break up. He was living in the house, he was sleeping on the couch, they were going to try and work this stuff out.
Okay.
In the meantime, after telling, according to Dan, after telling his wife this, that same night, the phone call started again from Alex.
Okay.
So Dan picked up the phone, told Alex he had told his wife what had happened. She didn't believe it. And that's when Beth said she went on the phone and told Alex in no uncertain terms, you were to stay away from my husband, you were to stay away from my family, and if you ever come near us again, I will kill you.
String you up. Good.
Which is a bit prophetic, is that the right word?
Prophetic, yeah.
For to what's going to happen in the end here. Alex, though, was not going to fuck. Again, well, this bitch just isn't going to go away.
Mm.
Not going to happen. I hate saying that because she does have mental health issues, 100%. We'll look into that a little bit as well, but they're definitely, you know, something, some wires not put in the right place in their brain.
Yes.
So the next day after all this goes down, Beth goes to collect Ellen from school, where she is told that Ellen was collected a few hours earlier.
By who?
Her aunt, I think.
Oh.
Her aunt Alex.
Oh, her aunt Alex.
Yeah. So obviously cops were called. Beth is out looking for her. Dan is out looking for her. Dan is going to where he thinks, you know, the usual haunts of where him and Alex had been to,
yeah,
to try and figure out where the fuck his child was. In the meantime, Alex had taken Ellen to the nearby amusement park.
Oh, fun.
And they spent the day on roller coasters, eating candy floss, having fun, doing, you know,
nice
fun shit at the fun fair.
Yeah.
And then she dropped her off back home at the gate and drove off. So it was all a mind game kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, look what I can do.
Yeah.
Now, at this point, obviously, no matter, it's not ending well for Alex at this point, because at this point the cops are going to arrest her and she's going to go to jail for kidnapping at some point.
Mm.
But they got her home. Thing is, Beth didn't know about it. She didn't know she was home. She was still out frantically looking for Ellen and Alex.
Okay.
And got into a car crash in the meantime.
Ah.
Not a serious car crash, fender bender, but she was battered, bruised, you know, stiff, and spent a few hours in hospital, and I think they kept her overnight for observation kind of thing.
Okay.
And then she went home the next day.
Okay.
Her and Dan had kind of spoken in the meantime, and they kind of decided they were going to fix this. They were going to work together. They were going to work through it.
Mm.
They weren't going to let this woman ruin their, what they had spent years and years and years building together.
Yeah.
They weren't going to let one mistake ruin their lives, basically.
Okay.
But Dan was going to suffer for it. So when they get home, both Dan and Ellen, or Dan and Beth say that Dan was pampering her. He was trying to fucking suck up a bit, cooking dinner, making sure she was comfortable, and giving her time on the couch, watching TV, and then he ran a bath for her.
Well, I would hope that he'd do that even if he wasn't sucking up to her.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But again, look.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ellen said, or not Ellen, Ellen was a child. Beth says she was preparing to get into the bath, and Dan was downstairs making her a cup of tea when she looked in the mirror and saw Alex standing behind her. Now, I don't know about you, but after the bunny incident and after my daughter being kidnapped incident, I'd have been putting decent security on my fucking doors.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There'd have been extra locks. Mm-hmm. There'd have been extra everything.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a cop outside the... I would want a cop stationed outside
the door.
A squad car outside my door until she was arrested.
Yeah, yeah.
But there she stood, knife in hand, and apparently delusional, asking Beth what she was doing in her house.
Ooh.
What she thought she was doing with her man. And she then attacked Beth. There was a struggle on the floor with the knife.
Mm.
Eventually, the knife spun out of control. Dan heard and hearing the ruckus, came upstairs, attacked fucking Alex.
Yeah.
Threw her into the bath and dunked her head under and held her under there.
Okay.
Until she passed out. Okay. Well, until he thought she was dead.
Okay.
Which obviously did not fare well for Dan later in court. But the thing was, she wasn't dead.
Mm.
And Dan had come in with a gun as well. Dan had a gun handy, like, because he was a bit wary about all this fucking going down.
Yeah.
But the gun had spun out in the struggle as well. He hadn't had to use it since he had her in the water, but it had spun out of his pocket in the struggle.
Okay.
Alex burst out of the bath, looking to attack again with a knife close to Dan.
Yeah.
And that is when Beth, apparently, now this is disputed because we're going to get into the court case next. Beth took the shot that killed Alex first, apparently.
Okay.
But we'll get into that a little bit more now in a few minutes.
Okay. So not women's finest moment. So let's take a look at one of the most courageous women in history to balance the scales. And this is a well-known story, one story we've all heard but bears repeating. On December the 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks boarded a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Instead of going to the back of the bus, which was designated for African-Americans, she sat in the front. When the bus started to fill up with white passengers, the bus driver asked Park to move, and she refused. Her resistance set in motion one of the largest social movements in history, the Montgomery bus boycott. Rosa Louise McCauley was born on February the 4th, 1913, in Tuskegee, Alabama. As a child, she went to an industrial school for girls and later enrolled at the Alabama State Teachers College for Negroes, present-day Alabama State University. Unfortunately, Parks was forced to withdraw after her grandmother became ill. Growing up in the segregated South, Parks was frequently confronted with racial discrimination and violence. She became active in the civil rights movement at a young age. Parks married a local barber by the name of Raymond Parks when she was 19. He was actively fighting to end racial injustice. Together, the couple worked with many social justice organizations. Eventually, Rosa was elected secretary of the Montgomery chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP. By the time Parks boarded the bus in 1955, she was an established organizer and leader in the civil rights movement in Alabama. Parks not only showed active resistance by refusing to move, but she also helped organize and plan the Montgomery bus boycott. Many have tried to diminish Parks' role in the boycott by depicting her as a seamstress who simply did not want to move because she was tired. Parks denied the claim and years later revealed her true motivation. She said, "People always say I didn't give up my seat because I was tired, but that isn't true. I was not physically or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old, although some have an image of me as being old then. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in." Park's courageous act and subsequent Montgomery bus boycott led to the integration of public transportation in Montgomery. Her actions were not without consequence. She was jailed for refusing to give up her seat and lost her job for participating in the boycott. After the boycott, Parks and her husband moved to Hampton, Virginia, and later permanently settled in Detroit, Michigan. Parks' work proved to be invaluable in Detroit's civil rights movement. She was an active member of several organizations which worked to end inequality in the city. By 1980, after consistently giving to the movement, both financially and physically, Parks, now widowed, suffered from financial and health troubles. After almost being evicted from her home, local community members and church came together to support Parks. On October 24th, 2005, at the age of 92, she died of natural causes, leaving behind a rich legacy of resistance against racial discrimination and injustice.
92? I don't remember her. Until 2005. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Not that I don't remember. I didn't remember her dying. Something that it seems like should be in my memory.
Mental.
Yeah.
But then again, I was a teenager in 2005 and didn't really care about anything that wasn't metal music and metal music.
Yeah.
So it may seem like a happy ending for the Gallaghers because they got rid of Alex and they could live happily ever after. But the ghost of Alex Forrest, not Frost, God damn it, last time I had to say her name and I did it again, would continue to follow them, with investigations dragging up dirty details of Dan's affair with her. And the ensuing trial brought on a lot of heat in the couple too. Mainly because, again, like I said earlier, a lot of people never saw the crazy side of Alex. You know, a lot of people saw her as a hardworking, career-driven, independent woman. So the idea of her losing her mind and doing all these things was unfathomable. I don't know why I keep putting that word in there, because I find it so hard to say. But but they find it, you know, just crazy to even think that she could do this.
Yeah.
So it took a lot for Dan and Beth to prove
that she was at fault.
They were justified in the murder of her. I mean, at this point, the evidence all did point to the fact that Alex had done all these things. The evidence did point to the fact that she was, obviously, she was in their fucking bathroom when she shouldn't have been. I don't know, when she shouldn't have been, while the police were out looking for her.
Exactly.
But it was, again, the Gallaghers told the truth about what happened that night. And questions came up to why a fully grown man, strong man, young man like Dan held Alex underwater to the point where he thought he had killed her. And why his wife Beth felt it necessary to put a bullet in her head when she could have easily aimed lower and incapacitated the woman.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of kind of discussion there with how that went, especially with all the character references in Alex's favor. But in the end, Dan and Bette were found innocent on grounds of self-defense. But the toll of the investigation, trial, and testimony was all too much for Bette, who in 1990 divorced Dan. Dan also lost his job due to the scandal and was resigned to working as a public defender for the rest of his career. So,
hope he had his money made.
Huh?
Hope he had his money made.
Oh, Beth took the most of that. No. And I'm pretty sure as well, I read something about Alex's father taking out some sort of wrongful death suit against him as well, that he did not win.
Oh, get fucked, Alex's father.
Yeah, because he's pretty... Yeah, he was a bit of a dick too, wasn't he? Yeah. Forgot about that.
Yeah.
Cheater, screw the cheater.
That's what he was trying to do.
But what do you think about all that? I stick by it. I think
there's two at wrong there, two at fault.
Everybody's a fucking fault.
I don't think Beth's at fault.
No. Beth was good.
I think the father's at fault. I think Alex is at fault. I think...
See, can you fault Alex? I mean,
I think you can fault Alex.
If Dan could have manned up a little earlier, it mightn't have escalated to the point it escalated to. If Dan had realised... From early on, I mean, I think the slitting of the wrist straight away will be a situation of shit. I might have to fight.
But that slitting, that wasn't intent to kill. That was attention seeking.
Which means she's not. If this is the level she's willing to go to get attention, how much further is she going to go after this?
Which is why I think she's at fault.
But it's a mental illness. Why didn't he, you know, work harder at making sure she was getting, like, well, find family members to put her in contact with, to get in contact or just control the situation, find friends, find something. Instead of going to the hospital yourself and dealing with it, track down someone that you can send to her for help. Go to where she works and ask.
And I'm just going to point out, though, right, she might have had a mental illness, but she also knows right from wrong. And if he did tell her that she had a wife, she should have been like, both of them should have been like, okay, there's a wife here. She should have been like, he's married. I'm going to back out before. Exactly. That is why she is also at fault. She is, even if you have a mental illness, you have, if you still have that capacity, like, to know that somebody's married, surely.
What? No, mental illness.
What's going on with her? I don't mean mental illness.
If he's willing to sleep with me, he's obviously not as happy at home as he's leading on to be. Do you know? And I would agree with that. Like, you know, if I was a single man and a woman came to me who was attached to sleep with me, my thought would be she is not happy or being satisfied at home, so she needs to come to me. So there is an attachment there, you know. There's clearly, she couldn't have a happy home life if she needs to come somewhere else to get this side of things. So I think that will be Alex. No, obviously, when someone tells you, I am not interested, fuck off and leave me alone, that's where kind of the point of you should know better. But things kept escalating and escalating and escalating for her. But if she's
I don't think if all the blame is on her, but I do think that like
what
both
about those
both
people
are at
have like manic episodes, like.
I know, yeah, but if she's out at a party and she's talking and she, you know, like, as in she's clearly, she's been normal to everybody else around her so far, like you said.
But that was up until the point where she got into this relationship.
Yeah, I mean, you do see the issue spiral out, like, to the stage, you know, like, where you're saying that, like, you know, she's turning up in the home.
Yeah, that does seem, but again, then the whole being able to go to the fun fair with the kid and drop him home, that's calculated.
That's very
knowing,
lucid.
That's knowing that you're playing mind games.
She is partly to blame, yeah.
And what
if she killed somebody, I am pretty sure she couldn't get off on the mental, as in because of literally what you said, you went to the house, you brought something with you, you crept around so nobody else would see you, so you could turn up behind her, in the bathroom. Like you said, the kidnapping, it's all very calculated.
Yeah. I don't know. Moral of the story here is just keep it in your pants, guys. Save it for the missus. Tip, anytime you're about to do something stupid like cheating, go have a quick wank first. Bet you'll be thinking a bit clearer after, and I'm certain it will reduce the chances of cheating or crazy women coming to your wife's bathroom to try and kill her.
Or just be a decent human being with a little self-control.
Yeah. Yeah, you can do that too.
Yeah.
So next week we're getting into a big one, getting spooky and supernatural in the horrorverse, so I gotta go get stuck into that now. So until then, you know what to do. Follow us on socials at Alive Alive Pod and check out our Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod. Yeah, It's Alive Alive Pod, that's it. For great shows like our true crime show Real Monsters and Amy's great history podcast Playing With Bones, that's an awesome one again this week. And there might be more on Playing With Bones soon. We might be giving it a bit of a bump.
Mm-hmm.
Might be getting a promotion. Along with the classic episodes of Behind the Mask and early access to Creepypasta Crypto Mini Monsters. And I got one more thing to say about that. We also have now added a 7-day free trial. So if you are unsure, you don't know whether you want to listen to us more, if you're sick of listening to us and you're like, maybe I want to hear a little more, maybe I don't, just go over. You get 7 days to check it out and see. And we got at least fucking 25 to 30 episodes of true crime and movie stuff and no history stuff, and you'll get your mini monsters and your creepypasta crypts a little bit early.
All that, and you get ad-free access to our main show and the weekend update, all for just $5 a month. That on Patreon is at It's Alive Alive.
So we'll be back next Wednesday with more tales from the horrorverse. It's Alive Alive Podcast, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt. See you all next time, same Alive Alive time, same horrorverse channel. Okay, love you, bye-bye.
Hey lady, I love you, bye-bye.